assuming that most of us are here, it's very good to have you with us. My name is Joshua Kellard. I'm the Outreach Coordinator at Christian Heritage in Cambridge. You'll probably have picked up that this is a picture behind me, but the events that we run are normally hosted at the Round Church. But it's a great pleasure and joy to be able to extend our reach and offer webinars at this time. I hope this evening finds you doing well. We're in for a real treat tonight as we have an evening with Gary Habermas, a New Testament scholar who has spent the lion's share of his scholarly time looking at the resurrection. And we're going to get a chance to hear from him in just a moment's time. It's for me to say that this is going to be a webinar in three movements. So the first section is going to be an interview with Dr. Habermas and our director, Kevin Moss. And Kevin's going to be asking Dr. Habermas more about the field of resurrection studies, how he got into it, and what exciting facets of that field he's been delving into most recently. From that, we're going to segue into a time where we're going to hear from Dr. Habermas directly. And he's going to share some of the things he's been looking into recently. And then the third segment, we're going to allow a long time for Q&A with Dr. Habermas, where you are very welcome to ask any question that you may have brought with you or that may occur in the course of the proceedings tonight. So that's the shape of the evening. Really looking forward to getting into this subject, the death of death, how Easter changes everything. And I'm sure you'll agree this is a really fascinating time to be talking about the resurrection. Just a few things to highlight of a practical nature, and that is when we do come to the Q&A, Kevin will mention this later, but when we do come, and if you'd like to ask a question, you should be able to see the reactions button on your screen. And if you go down there, you can hover over reactions right now, in fact, and you can see all the different things you can do. If you've got a question, please just use that to raise your hand. If there's any problem at any point, you can't raise your hand for some reason, it just won't go up, then feel free to shoot me or my colleague John Savage a message in the chat. And with that, I'm going to hand over now to our director at Christian Heritage, Kevin Moss, who's going to lead this evening's session.
Thank you, Josh. Thank you very much indeed. Welcome to you all. Thank you for taking the opportunity to spend a few minutes with us this evening thinking about the resurrection of Christ. Quick introduction for myself. I have been with Christian Heritage on the board of trustees for 10 years now, but I stepped in as director of operations this January. Rather more involved than I used to be. I have a master's degree in Christian apologetics from Biola University in the States, and I'm currently studying for a PhD in intellectual history in Aberystwyth University. And I love Christian Heritage. I've been involved with it for 20 years now in total. So that's me. Dr. Gary Habermas, I've known since 2015. And in fact, Gary and his wife came and stayed with us in Cardiff a few years back when he very kindly ran a whole weekend of events for us at our church, Highfields Church in Cardiff. Dr. Habermas is a distinguished research professor of apologetics and philosophy at Liberty University in Virginia. He lectures around the world on the evidence for the historical Jesus, and he presents the case for the resurrection. He is widely published. And to prepare for tonight, I had a look on Amazon just to see what you could get your hands on if you really wanted to buy yourself some genuine Habermas at the event of this evening's event. And there's his book, The Case for the Resurrection of Jesus, which he co-wrote with Mike Lacona. That's still available. There's a newer book, Gary, I'd not come across this, Evidence for the Historical Jesus. Is Jesus of History the Christ of Faith? There's the one I've got on my shelf, which is an older book called The Historical Jesus, which looks like it's only available now in Kindle. And there's another interesting little book I bought years ago called The Secret of the Talpiot Tomb. Perhaps I'll ask you about that in a moment, Gary, when we're looking at our questions. So we've known each other a few years, And I thought I would lead him in gently and hopefully give you all a bit of a sense of where he's coming from in this subject. So, Gary, if I may start the ball rolling by asking you, you've come to kind of specialise in this subject, the resurrection of Christ. How has that been, and why did that happen?
Well, first of all, Kevin and everybody else, Josh and John, it is great to be with you tonight. I've spoken in the Round Church before in person, and I love the scenery around there. I'm a history nut, and if you take a real quick little story here, a number of years ago, I was in Oxford, and I turned left to go down one of the main streets in Oxford. And of course, Oxford's nickname is the City of 100 Medieval Spires. And when I turned the corner, my wife was with me, and we'd been there many times. And I looked up, and I saw the spires, and I just went, "Ah!" Oh. And she goes, "Come on, come on. You've seen this 100 times." But that's just the feeling here. So to be with you folks in front of Round Church, I mean, it's great for me. As far as study the resurrection, I'm asked frequently in interviews, people assume that I'm a much better guy than I am. And they think, well, you must have got into this because you wanted to help people, right? You wanted to give them good evidences for Christianity and help them with their doubts and minister to them. And I was a pastor for a while, and that's no doubt why you wanted to do this, right? And I said, no, that's way too altruistic for me. I got into the resurrection because I had severe doubts. And I went through doubts for about 10 straight years, where it was the dominating thing of my life. The 1-2 punch of my life was sports of various sorts, especially in the U.S., American football and ice hockey. And then when I would come in at night, immediately the question was, where did I leave off from my study the night before? And that was my study of the resurrection. And I didn't know what I could believe, what was true, what was false. And people gave me all sorts of options. They said, well, have you thought about this? Have you thought about creation? Have you thought about prophecy? Have you thought about the historical reliability of the New Testament? Have you thought about archaeology and all the things that proves the Bible, you know? And I'm thinking, so I checked out each one of those. And I thought, decent, not good enough. Decent, not good enough. That was my verdict for everything. Decent, wished it went further. And then one day it dawned on me that if the resurrection of Jesus occurred, it could support all my doubts, not only about the fact of the resurrection, and therefore not only about the truth of who Jesus was, but also the truth of who we are. The name of your broadcast today, the death of death and beyond, that was really what was on my mind. Because a few years before, I had lost the most important person in my life. Happened to be my great-grandmother, but at that time, she was closer to me than anybody in my life, including my parents. And so death was on my mind for a good many years during this time when I was studying the resurrection. But I was also thinking about the future, because in the New Testament, the resurrection is linked to almost every area of theology and practice. And the one that's mentioned most times, almost 20, is that because Jesus was raised, believers will be raised. That connection of if Jesus, then believers. So I thought, in one event here, I can go from theoretically from resurrection all the way to assurance of our futures and meaning in life. And that's what got me to dig in. And from that point on, I've never given up on the resurrection. Now, years later, helping other people through doubt and all that, that came later. But at the beginning, I hate to say it, but it was pretty much for me. I was doing it because I felt lost in a meaningless world, and I wondered what there was worth believing in.
Okay, thank you very much. Let's just develop that point a little bit more, Gary. I'm interested in how that emphasis on the resurrection delivers value to you when you are talking to other groups of people, perhaps particularly skeptics, people who are not themselves religious or Christian believers. How do you find your approach to the resurrection tends to help people in that category?
Well, let's put it this way. I don't think there's any subject about which we're speaking. I don't think there's any subject of more value than the resurrection, because I truly believe it relates to, if you were doing an ABCD quiz, it would be the all of the above square that you want to check, all the above, because the resurrection does all of that. And I told you years before, my great-grandmother died, and when I was going through all my doubts, I was formulating my own views of death and dying. Well, many years later, studying the resurrection, my wife of 23 years and the mother of our four children died of stomach cancer. And that's the other end. What does the resurrection do when our most treasured loved ones and our most treasured dreams are taken away from us? And I published this in a few places, but I had some make-believe discussions with God at that time. And my wife was upstairs in bed, dying of stomach cancer, and I had a child monitor up there so I could hear every move. And every time she even coughed, I went running upstairs and she had merely turned over. She was sleeping large parts of the day. My children were in school. And I went out and sat on the front porch. It was just warming up here. And this make-believe conversation with God, I was talking to God and asking, why should my wife die? They'd already told me it was terminal and there was nothing they could do about it. Why should she die at age 43 when everything was going to fall on me from, you know, first of all, just losing her was by far the worst thing. But then I was realizing in levels here that somebody had to get the kids dressed in the morning and off to school. Somebody had to get breakfast. Somebody had to allow for lunch. Somebody had to fix dinner. Somebody had to help with homework. Somebody get the kids tonight. And I truly believe the Lord had led me to teach at Liberty University. I thought, well, Lord, how does this all go? Why are you letting this happen to me? And I don't want you to hear the me thing. The major question was, why her? Why her at age 43? Mm-hmm. And in our make-believe conversation, the Lord told me, He asked me, what kind of a world was this? And I said, well, I don't know, Lord. I'm talking about her dying. I guess it's a world where Jesus died and you raised him from the dead. And he said, that's a good starting point. Now, what can you know in a world like that? Well, I know there's meaning in life. I know you exist. I know there's a future. I know there's eternal life, but what about her? And then I pictured him saying, you know, I know what you're going through, which according to counseling books is the last thing you tell somebody who's got a dying person in their family. But the Lord said in my make-believe conversation, I know what you're going through. And I said, how so? And he said, because I watched my son die. Now, at that time, I thought there were only two kinds of pain in the world that came close to mind: losing a spouse or losing a child. I thought nothing else even paled in comparison. And so when the Lord reminded me that he watched his son die, I perked up. And then I said, but Lord, don't you want to heal her? And he said, Gary, if I explained all the pros and cons of this, you wouldn't even know where I was going anyway. There's no need for me to start this conversation. I just want to assure you that there will come a day And at the time, I couldn't repeat the sentence, but I pictured the Lord saying, there will come a day when in eternity you will be walking hand in hand with your wife. But for now, I'm not going to explain why you guys are suffering. That'll have to be enough for you. And I learned then that this is basically the theme of the book of Job, that Job realized that he knew enough about God to trust him in those things he couldn't know. And I decided there on the front porch in this make-believe conversation to trust the Lord in the things I didn't know, i.e. why was my wife dying, and to trust him for the future and for the joyous reunion in heaven later, all guaranteed by the resurrection. So there you go, Kevin. You went from my doubt to my questions to current meaning in life, all the way to the future, all the way to heaven, walking hand in hand with my soon-to-be deceased wife, and she died a very short time later. That was all in the game, and the resurrection was the very center of it and produced all the meaning and force for all of that history and doubt and existential need in the present.
Now, I remember you telling us about that back in 2000, I think it was 2015. And at that time, we had just buried my son, who had died the previous year, and a whole series of other very close relatives. You may remember that. And my wife, Mag, said that that was about the only thing that somebody had said to her that really made sense of those circumstances, that conversation you imagined in your head. And I couldn't help but feel that it was a more of a real conversation than an imaginary one in terms of what it delivered for you at that time. It certainly helped us. So given that that is so significant, I'm running off slightly here, but I think this is an important thing. Why do you think it is that the big atheist apologists, people like Richard Dawkins, Christopher Hitchens, and people like that, why do you think it is that they pay so little attention to the resurrection of Christ?
Wow, that is a loaded question. I think there's a lot of reasons. I think one reason is, as the two of them say, as Hitchens used to say, and as Dawkins still says, the resurrection is such a minuscule event in the whole history of the world. It's a little nothing in the small, dark corner of the world that nobody cares about. Why should anybody care about it? That's one reason, I think. I think another reason is because they can't deal with it. I think in a dialogue, they would not stand a chance making it to first base or second base, using American sport there, but I think y'all know what baseball is. They wouldn't get to first base, second base, third base on the evidence. They wouldn't be able to deal with it. The evidence for the resurrection, if you gave a little bit of evidence and stopped and asked them to explain it, I think they'd get frustrated and get lost. So on the one hand, they really do consider it a very small nothing event, when Richard in particular was at least all about science at Oxford. But on the other hand, I think they often put the resurrection down because they don't want to deal with the data.
No.
They don't want a discussion. And Richard Dawkins especially always avoids dialogue on this subject. He's done it many times.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. That's helpful. Thank you very much indeed. I wanted to ask you whether there is anything particularly new in your own work and your own thinking that you think is particularly helpful for understanding Christ's resurrection. It's always helpful to catch up. This is a few years after you and I last talked. So what's happened in the meantime? Where has your work taken you? What do you think is the significance of it?
Well, you're asking a very specific question, and that's good. You're asking basically, what have we come to find out in the last 5 or 6 years?
Yeah.
And of all the developments for the resurrection, I personally, I argue what I call a minimal facts argument for the resurrection of Jesus. So I, when I go to universities, I will often say, "So let me ask you students a question. If the New Testament is inspired, was Jesus raised from the dead?" And they'll say, "Well, yeah, if New Testament was inspired, but who believes that anymore?" Okay. Now, what if the New Testament is not inspired, but it's a very reliable book? Was Jesus raised from the dead? And they would very smartly say, "It depends on what part's reliable and what part's not." Okay, that's good. That's good. Say, what would happen if the New Testament was the worst it could be? The New Testament was an unreliable book. Is there a chance for the resurrection? And I think they would say, absolutely not. And I would say, at the beginning of my lecture, that's what I'm here for tonight. I'm here to tell you that on the most unreliable New Testament there could be, scholarly speaking, I'm not talking about lay people who just go off on the Bible no matter what. Scholarly, people who have terminal degrees in New Testament and related fields. On a scholarly subject, here's what I'm here to tell you. I can use those skeptics' facts and show that a resurrection occurred. The resurrection happened on an unreliable New Testament, if that's what it is. If it's inspired, we've got the best. If it's unreliable, that's the worst. Here's what holds the same. We have resurrection all the way across. So if the resurrection is that bad, if the New Testament is that bad, we still have a resurrection. So they would ask me how, and I would explain evidences and how we know Jesus was dead and appeared afterwards. One, by the way, one American scholar, he's retired now, but he used to teach at Oxford. And then he came back to this country and spent the last few years of his public career at Duke University, one of our, one of our top five or eight universities in the country. And then he retired. And he wrote a book. He wrote several books. He's given credit, E.P. Sanders, he's given credit for kicking off the third quest for the historical Jesus, the movement we're in right now. But he said in his book, He said, I'm a liberal. But the fact that the disciples had real experiences with Jesus after he died is something that is allowed across the board in scholarship. You go, wow, where were you teaching? Oxford and Duke. And what's your field? New Testament. And supposedly you started the third quest for the historical Jesus? Well, that's what people say, supposedly. And you think more scholars than that, you think it's a given today? The vast preponderance of scholars allow that Jesus was raised? You say, well, I don't know what he looked like. That's what he says, actually, a couple times. I don't know what form, but yeah, they saw him later. And you say, what has happened to contemporary scholarship? I'd say the most exciting thing, Kevin, the most exciting single thing is the key word early, which is one of the facts in the New Testament. When I first started lecturing on the resurrection years ago, people were still being inclined to use Mark or Matthew, often called the earliest gospels. Now, Mark, according to most scholars, don't give an account of the appearances. So Matthew, Luke, and we're talking already 40 to 50 years away after the cross. Now, before anybody says anything, that is an extremely short time in ancient history. When you think that the earliest biography of Alexander the Great was almost 300 years later, and the best biographies of Alexander the Great, Plutarch and Arrian, are about 450, almost half a millennium, are the best biographies of one of the best known personalities in the world. You go, well, you're just picking a bad example. Actually, I'm not picking a bad example. Let's use a religious example, Buddha. The earliest sources for Buddha and that he was a miracle worker, according to one Buddhist scholar, are 600 to 800 years after Buddha was born. So even if you use the Gospels, that was extremely good. But then years ago, they were already backing it up. And critics' favorite scholar today is the Apostle Paul. They think Paul is the key authority in the New Testament. And of the 13 epistles that have Paul's name on them, critics will give you 7 of them. You can cite 7 of them to your heart's content. That doesn't mean everything in them is true, but that means Paul's a scholar. I often say Paul had an equivalent of a PhD in Old Testament. He was a Pharisee. He knew how to study scripture, but he was somebody who put his shoe leather or sandal leather to work by capturing men, women, and children and dragging them off to prison. He was in the right place for people to know. And Paul's earliest book is 1 Thessalonians, 50 AD. Now we're only 20 years after the cross. But the most exciting thing in recent years is the development of information about the early creeds in the New Testament. There are dozens of early statements embedded in the New Testament books, which scholars have a bunch of reasons. Now remember, these scholars are pretty quote-unquote liberal scholars, and they allow that these early creeds go all the way back, for the most part, all the way back to 1 to 2 years, maybe 3 years, after the death of Jesus. That's how far they go back. So you get the Gospels at plus 40, 60, 65. You got Paul at plus 20, starting at plus 20. But these go back immediately after the time. Gerrit Ludemann, an atheist New Testament scholar, says that the earliest reports, the earliest creeds we have, started immediately after the events themselves. That's Gerrit Ludemann. Larry Hurtado, he's American, but he's well known to British crowds because he was the chair of religion at Edinburgh University for years until he just passed away recently. Larry Hurtado also says days or months after the resurrection. Jimmy Dunn of Durham also just passed away recently. But Jimmy Dunn said the earliest report of resurrection is months after the event. But here's the most radical one. Bart Ehrman, who's probably the best-known New Testament critic in North America, and an atheist, non-Christian atheist, he says all the early creedal passages that Paul quotes, like 1 Corinthians 15, 3 and following, that list of appearances, he says they were probably all in existence before Paul was converted. That's 2 to 3 years after the cross. He says they were probably all in existence before Paul. They were in Jerusalem, came from Jerusalem. Paul knew them. And you ready for this one? Probably came from the apostles themselves. You go, wow. Right after the cross, yes, immediately. In Jerusalem, or from Jerusalem, yes. Before Paul was converted, at plus 2 to 3 years later, yes. And maybe or probably came from the apostles themselves, yes. Well, we better start studying these things. Well, there's dozens of them. And it's been estimated that 80% of these early creeds celebrate the gospel data, namely the deity, death, and resurrection of Jesus. They don't just do anything in early Christianity. They zero in on the deity, death, and resurrection of Jesus. And these things are being dated now to immediately after the cross. No wonder Paul traveled around angry. No wonder he stomped on people and killed people and dragged them and held the coat for those who stoned Stephen. He knew these creeds were around, and I think he was probably pretty ticked. He's probably pretty upset what these guys were teaching, how they were making light of the Old Testament, making fun of the law, and trampling under their feet everything Paul thought was sacred until he met the risen Jesus on the way to Damascus. And then it was like the light coming on, and Paul knew what it was. That's the most exciting thing, Kevin, is how the date for the eyewitness testimony has moved back from the Gospels to the epistles of Paul beginning in 50 AD, all the way back to 30-ish AD, and almost nobody denies that we have statements about the resurrection, authoritative statements, back in that early period. That is, when you use that in a debate, it takes a really sharp guy to be able to get around that argument.
Now, you mentioned one of those sharp guys, didn't you? Bart Ehrman. And Bart Ehrman seems to have admitted the validity of those arguments. So how does he get around it? Do you know? Why doesn't it have a logical impact on him?
First of all, the six facts that I use, that I call the minimal facts, he admits all of them. He admits every one of them. All right, so now the question you're asking, why doesn't he become a believer? Well, whenever anybody asks me that, and I get that question almost every time I lecture on this, if Gerrit Ludemann, the German atheist, Bart Ehrman, the American atheist, liberals like self-styled liberal, like E.P. Sanders, if they call themselves these things, and yet they allow these data, by the way, Pinchas Lapid, a non-Christian Jewish PhD in New Testament, affirmed the resurrection. He said it actually happened, and we have eyewitness testimony for it, says this Jewish scholar. Pinchas Lapid is his name, Pinchas Lapid. And it's okay. Why do they admit him? Why don't they come to the body of Christ? Well, when that happens, I tell a little story, and this story will help. I want to say any more. The story explains why these people don't believe. Kevin, let's say you and I are best friends, and I'm married and you're not. Now, you have a lovely wife that we've had the privilege of meeting and spending time with, and I know you're totally all about her. We saw that in person in Wales. But let's just say we're best friends. I'm married, and I know a relationship like that, but you don't. You're single. But we're best friends. And I've met a person that I just think, since I'm happily married, you should be happily married because we're best friends. So I want to introduce you to this person. And I do. And I say, come on, go out for a meal. Go see a movie. Go do something. And you say, well, I hate blind dates. But because we're best friends, I'll do that. And you go out several times. Next time I see you, I say, how is it going with this person? And you say, I'm going to tell you something, man. You know me really well. This is the neatest person I've ever met in my life. She is fantastic. And I jump in and I say, Kevin, can I be your best man? Can I be your best man? And you go, whoa, dude, time out. You're assuming that because she's the most incredible person I've ever met, that I want to get married. But that doesn't follow, because she could be the greatest person I've ever met and me not wanting to be tied down right now. I don't want to get married. I think that is what's going on. The main reason with skeptics who don't want to come to the Lord, I think, is they, quote unquote, don't want to be tied down. You're asking somebody to believe facts, and then you're asking them to say, I do, to Jesus. You're asking them to have a relationship with Jesus. You know, when I say I do to Jesus, it is interesting that in the Old and New Testaments both, God the Father is the husband, and the church, or ancient Israelites, are the bride. So that language is frequently used. And in marriage, we say I do to somebody. And then again, with my story, Kevin, you're my best friend. You're not willing to say I do just yet. You don't want a relationship. And I think there's a lot of people in this world that can be convinced of any number of facts, but they don't want a relationship. And I think that split between data and commitment is the reason why this happens.
Okay. That makes a huge amount of sense, doesn't it? So how does that affect the way you communicate the truths or the facts of the resurrection to an audience which may be largely skeptical or partly skeptical when you recognize that? How does communicating the facts help them if they are people like the unattached?
Yeah, great question. This interview is, I mean, this is super. You're going right down the right lines here. I would say that all I can do is a lecturer. especially when I'm going to these universities or other places, I only have one or two cracks at these folks. The best I could do is A, give the evidence, be faithful to God's word. I've been faithful to God's word, even though I'm in principle using a New Testament that's unreliable. But of course, my point is, if the resurrection happens with an unreliable New Testament, it certainly happens with an inspired New Testament. So I want them to hear the message of salvation. I tell them about what it means to say I do to Jesus. And by the way, that I do language is not just the bride and the groom and the bride throughout the Bible, but also the Greek word pistuo or pistis, the noun for believe. It means to fully commit. It means to go all in. The word is much stronger than our English word for believe. My Greek professor used to say John 3:16 could be translated, "For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten son, that whosoever commits himself to him will not perish but have eternal life." So I can only take them down that path, try to be true to scripture, argue for the truthfulness of the resurrection, talk to them about an I do relationship, and leave it. Right? I can't have an invitation in a secular university, either in the US or in the UK. So I leave it. What I'll be doing is what a good friend of mine, probably known over there in the UK pretty well, Greg Kokel, who's a very well-known apologist himself. Mm. Greg Kokel says to crowds, this is one of the coolest one-liners I've ever heard. He says, "You guys might try to think I'm trying to convert you. I'm not trying to convert you. I'm trying to put a stone in your shoe." And that's what I have to do at universities, right? I put a stone in their shoe. And I'm hoping that a month or a day or a year later, they will be bothered about that whole discussion until it eats at them enough to come to the Lord. And by the way, you know, when I'm usually in these universities, I'm sponsored by Christian organizations. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of people to hold there's a lot of Christians there to hold these folks' hands and to talk them through the relationship if they want to do that. The Christian groups will see to that. So they'll try to get them into a Bible study, try to get them to say, "I do" to Christ. Mm-hmm. So, but all I can do is present it up front, tell them that they need a relationship with the Jesus, and my night's over. Now, frequently I will tell them, "I will stay here till the janitors kick us out of the room. So if you want to come up and talk, do it." Well, the lecture starts at 7 o'clock. It's over by 8:30. We have some Q&A, you know, it's over by 8:30. And I often stay there till 11 o'clock at night. And I'll be surrounded by a group of anywhere from 5 to 30 people. And they'll be firing questions and we'll talk the whole night. I literally have been kicked out by janitors and we have to go out in the lobby and talk. But that's my job. That's what it's about. I'm coaxing. It's like Paul says, some plant, some water, some reap. You know, I'm doing the planting and maybe just a little tiny bit of watering there before I leave.
And I think that's an encouraging message for all of us who are intent on sharing the gospel with our non-Christian friends and people out there, isn't it? There is a limit to how far we can go. Can I ask you about one personal experience you had there many years ago? And at this point, I'm beginning to forget the name of the person I want to think of, but his first name was Anthony. He was a famous professor of philosophy and he was an atheist. And towards right at the end of his life, he came to a very different position. I know that you two are friends, and I don't want you to divulge conversations that you had, but my reading of what he said afterwards was that he said that the understanding that Christ did actually rise from the dead was the best explanation of the data that he was able to come up with. Do you want to comment on that a little bit? Because you did have some insight and involvement in that.
Sure, yes. His name was Anthony Flew, and there were four major world-renowned British atheists or agnostics who taught philosophy in those days. There's Bertrand Russell, there was A.J. Ayer, and there was, Tony's the last one of them. J.L. Mackey's the third one, and then Flew. Flew was the last living one. The other three had all passed away, and Tony was the last one. I debated Tony on the resurrection in 1985. He came to our university, Liberty, and we debated here before a pretty big crowd and on the resurrection. And he stayed around for a couple of weeks. He's actually he was a student of the American Civil War. And one of my colleagues took him around to several Civil War battlefields. And he spoke to our graduate students in philosophy. And we didn't care what he said. He could say whatever he wanted. And so that was that first time. He and I debated on the resurrection two more times. And I'm not saying anything that occurred to him was because of me, because a lot of other people, a lot of major people had befriended Tony. But about a year and a half after our last debate, I had heard that he had become a theist. And I called him on the phone in Reading, in the UK there, and we were talking. As I said, we were quite good friends. And I said, Tony, I heard that you've become a theist. And he said, well, he said, it seems like I've gone in that direction. I think the most logical result here is to believe in God. And but then he said in that phone call, he said, I'm not sure I've really become a theist. Maybe it's more accurate to say I'm still an atheist with big questions. I'm an atheist with big questions. He said, but I've got a publishing deal that's coming up real soon. Could you call me back in another week or two? And I said, sure. And I called him back about 2 weeks later. And he said, well, I've had time to think about our chat and what I said the last time. I was an atheist with big questions. But now I've made up my mind. I have become a theist. And when that news got out that the famous Anthony Flew, the last of the four British, the foursome, had become a theist, he would variously describe it either as deism or as theism. So months later, I interviewed him for a journal article, and the name of the article was My Pilgrimage from Atheism to Theism. Now, that was 2004, and he and I stayed good friends. I'd often call him at home in Reading. We would talk about everything. We talked about politics, what he thought about the world. He was a very, very ethically conservative person, and he just decried the things that were going on in America and in the UK in those days. And we would talk for a little bit, hang up. I'd call him again. We'd talk and hang up. We talked many times about the Gospels. He got sick later in his life, and we had less conversation. But he had heard the Gospel from me and others over and over and over and over. I cannot say if he ever became a Christian. I do not know. One of my friends said to me when we heard that Tony had died in 2010, one of my friends said to me, well, maybe in the wee hours of the morning, the Lord may have come to him. And he said, let's just hope that Tony Flew will be in the kingdom one day. Mm-hmm. And I said, I dearly hope that. There's not a more ethical, kind individual that I've ever met. I just hope he is. Mm-hmm. But he died, and as far as I know, he never became a Christian. But he did say, that Christianity was the most easily the best evidence of all the world religions. And yeah, he did say that the resurrection was the best evidence miracle claim in all the religions. Mm-hmm. So, and there was some evidence coming up at that time of an afterlife. He also said that it was looking more and more that there was some kind of an afterlife, which he had steadfastly not believed in for his whole life. Mm-hmm. So that's between he and the Lord. But, you know, I really fondly hope that that, you know, he found his way to the Lord.
Thank you. Thank you. Well, I think there's an encouragement for all of us here tonight who are Christians in that, you know, humanly speaking, Anthony Flew wasn't ever going to come to that kind of position, was he? And it's quite a remarkable turnaround at the end of his life. So I think we should see some encouragement in that. Now, we're going to open up for questions, folks. So if you would like to ask Dr. Habermas a particular question, now is the time to put your hand up. And I'm going to start scrolling through the list to see if there are any pinkies levitating. And I'll mention your name if you've got a question. And John Savage will spotlight you so you can then ask a question directly of Dr. Habermas. So you know how to do that. If you go down to reactions at the bottom of your screen, click on that. If you want to raise your hand, there's a little raise hand button. So do that and we'll field your question. You can ask Dr. Habermas directly yourself. And if you're feeling shy, I've got a few in reserve, which we can talk about. But don't feel shy. This is an opportunity. Oh, look, we got one. Right, Hugo. I'm going to ask John to spotlight Hugo. I happen to know Hugo. No favoritism here.
Hi. I just wanted to pick up on the last statement that you made. You started moving into the direction of evidence for life after death. And I just thought it might be interesting if you expanded on that. You were talking that about that as distinct from as distinct from the specifics of the resurrection of Jesus Christ. Thanks.
Yeah, just like there's more than one way to get to the existence of God, by more than one way, I mean, there's more than one good evidence, in my opinion, to get the existence of God. There are more paths than we need, actually, to show that eternal life is true. I would say to argue that eternal life is true, by far the best argument is the resurrection of Jesus, because the resurrection of Jesus gives a direct argument from, as I said earlier, almost 20 times we're told that believers will be raised from the dead like Jesus is. And as Jesus is still living, so we will be. So that's the best argument, I think, the strength of the resurrection for eternal life. As far as limited afterlife, like it starts and it goes for a while, but we don't know how long it goes. I think the strongest evidence is the latest research on near-death experiences. Mm-hmm. Next to the resurrection, this is the topic I have studied the most. And I'll just say real briefly that to answer that question, that we now have dozens, literally dozens of cases where somebody with no measurable brain or heart activity, no measurable brain or heart activity, reports events sometimes a ways away from the hospital or wherever they are. And all those events can be verified, even though as far as science can ascertain, their brains and hearts are not operating. And to all total, there are 300 evidential near-death experiences or more, actually way over. But of these flat heart, flat brain cases, according to what we can tell from machines, there are at least 3 to 4 dozen of those cases. So that's how I'd answer it. But see, the NDEs can't tell us that life, eternal life lasts forever. The resurrection does answer that question. So I would talk about NDEs as being a good empirical argument, but the resurrection is being the best argument to get us all the way to eternity.
Okay. Now, you and J.P. Moreland, the philosopher, have both of you got a very keen interest in this subject, haven't you?
We do.
And J.P. has, I think, made quite a bit of it in relation to combating naturalism.
Yep.
As a worldview. Would you like to speak on that just briefly?
Well, what I tell people is a lot of Christians kind of stumble when they hear near-death experiences, and they don't know what to do with it. They don't. They're okay with the data, but the most typical experience I hear is they are unsure because you'll get an atheist person who has an NDE, for example. A.J. Ayer, the third of those famous British atheists, A.J. Ayer had two near-death experiences toward the end of his life. And he was an atheist. He refused to say that he met God. So he told everybody he had an experience with the superintendent of the universe. That's what he called him. It was just silly. He wouldn't call him God. But he meets him. He stands in front of this person. And later, Ayer said, I'm slightly more sure that there's an afterlife than I was before these experiences. His testimony is just crazy. But when you answer a question like that, I think what bothers Christians the most is now Ayer said he was uncomfortable the whole time. Whatever it was, being in the presence of this person, he said he was profoundly uncomfortable. But there are a lot of testimonies where atheists say they had a good time and they don't have to become a believer because they're going to go back to heaven someday. Or maybe a Hindu or a Buddhist, and they'll say, I'm just going to go back to heaven someday. I don't have to become a Christian. And that bothers a lot of Christians. So they won't talk about NDEs. And the point I would want to make with believers is when you look for evidential data for near-death experience, the evidential data is this worldly. It's a this world. It's when you have no measurable brain or heart activity, but you see a car accident outside the hospital a half a mile away and you report the details, or you report what happens three floors away in the hospital waiting room where you're having surgery, and you can tell people blow for blow what happened in that emergency room in the waiting room with your family. But the minute that person sort of quote unquote whips away to heaven, those are just testimonies. We have no evidence for thinking that a Buddha met Jesus and said he was okay, that an atheist was told he was coming back from heaven. Those are just tales. I mean, we're surrounded here in this country, as you are in your country, by people of all different religions. And everybody gives testimonies about their own religions. So it shouldn't be a threat to anybody because those things are on evidence. When I tell a nice story of what happened to me in church last week, everybody listens and politely says, that's nice. It shouldn't bother Christians because those are not evidenced. Okay, back to naturalism. Near-death experiences do not help us to tell what religions are true or false. We cannot learn that from NDEs because that material about what religion is true is not evidenced. So it does not help us. But what it does help us to do, what near-death experiences show us, is that the Buddhist can stand shoulder to shoulder with the Hindu, can stand shoulder to shoulder with the Muslim, can stand shoulder to shoulder with the Jew, can stand shoulder to shoulder with the Christian. And we all agree there's an afterlife. And therefore, we don't know which religion is true. We're going to have to debate that out later. We don't know what religion is true. But here's what we do know. Naturalism is wrong. Because as Bertrand Russell used to say, the two ground forces of naturalism, the two main events, the two proclamations, there's no God and no afterlife. No God and no afterlife. If there's a God, A.J. Ayer seems to have met God. That's a problem for an atheist. But if there's an afterlife, that's the second most important thing. And if the naturalist finds out either that there's a God or that there's an afterlife, naturalism going down. The naturalist then at that point better decide they better start doing some research and finding out which religion they want to be a member of, because their group, naturalism, just got shot down. That's the value. That's the chief value of near-death experiences, to show you that A, naturalism is wrong, and B, we can hope for life beyond that barrier that we call death.
Okay, that's helpful. I think the naturalism thing is an important topic that we need to be addressing. There was a gentleman called Thomas Hallam who just had his hand up, but he's taken it down again. Thomas, do you want to ask a question? It's back up. He does. Thomas Hallam.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Cool. Slightly before I ask the question, I just want to sort of slightly apologize for a slightly weak question. I'm afraid I'm not very familiar with your six sort of major basic facts. So this isn't a question that I have sort of a particular weakness in mind when I'm asking, but I'm kind of thinking when I go away later and think about this and sort of look into it, this is kind of the question that I'll have in my mind. So I kind of want to ask it now, even though I don't know sort of the strength of it. So the question is, so you kind of have a sort of this sort of path, I think you sort of describe paths to the resurrection, these sort of pieces of evidence. Now, sort of when I'm thinking about sort of arguments and evidence, they're kind of thinking of like a balance, like there's, there might be good reasons to believe something, and, you know, these things might be strong, but they're sort of like counter pieces of evidence. Now, some counter pieces of evidence that atheists like often to go for will be things like, you know, sort of suffering the world, and yourself and Kevin have obviously talked about some of the deep suffering that you've experienced. But I wonder what, if you've sort of been sort of challenged on the point of like, how does your argument for these sort of basic facts fit in with sort of a balance? Are there sort of counter pieces of evidence, not necessarily for the resurrection itself, but sort of for sort of God in general, that sort of says, okay, well, yes, there's this evidence to think the resurrection occurred. But there's all these other pieces of evidence that sort of suggest that sort of either Christianity isn't true, or that God isn't sort of what the Bible says, that, you know, the evidence might stack against it. No, but just despite sort of the apparent strength, if you just look at the resurrection argument. So that's my question.
Good. That's great. You know what, Kevin, you having a lot of years in, I only teach at the PhD level in school, and I'm leery of these guys like Thomas who say, I've only got an introductory question here, and then he asks maybe the weightiest question in history. And that's, what about the suffering of the universe? You know, the whole book of Job, Abraham's life, David's life, Jesus on the cross, my God, why have you forsaken me? I mean, why suffering? Paul's thorn in the flesh? That's a great question, Thomas. Okay, let me go after this. You're right. The facts are weighed in the balance, and you do weigh arguments. Here's why I think the pain and suffering in the world does not touch the resurrection. And here's the reason. I'll give you a bunch of reasons, but here's one. Pain and suffering no more proves God does or doesn't exist than it goes after the resurrection. Let me say it differently. Atheists have as much problem with the problem of evil as Christians do. They both struggle the same amount. Now, let me try to explain that. People might think that suffering and evil support atheism or agnosticism. But actually, if you're an atheist, and if you're an atheist, and if you, not you, Thomas, but I mean, if the person is an atheist, and if they don't believe there are absolute ethics in the world, if they don't, absolute ethics. Now, sometimes atheists say there's absolute ethics, but when you question them, it's more pragmatic. They're not an absolute right and wrong. If you're an atheist and there's no absolute right and wrong, how would you recognize evil in the first place? C.S. Lewis says he was in his 30s when he became a Christian. He said, I was an atheist and I hated Christianity until it dawned on me one day that when I'm asking the problem of pain and suffering to Christians, it dawned on me that as an atheist, I have no apparatus even to recognize the problem of evil because I don't believe in an absolute right and wrong. And if there's not an absolute right and wrong, what is this suffering that I'm mad at God for? He says, all suffering would be is an inconvenience. All suffering would be, on the atheist view, is an inconvenience, something I don't like. It doesn't prove God is bad or non-existent. It doesn't prove Christianity is right. In fact, the Christian answer is the world is full of pain and suffering. But what if God has a better answer for allowing it? Now, I was in a debate one time on the problem of evil, and I said to the atheist, what if there was no reason to what if there were reasons for believing that God could allow pain and suffering? And the person said to me, well, that's fair. The atheist said, that's fair. If God has reasons to allow pain and suffering, then that's understandable. He said, what would some of those reasons be like? And I said, well, I can always use a theoretical one. I can always talk about suffering in the world that's redeemed by the death of Jesus on the cross, and that in the gospel of Christ itself is about evil, because it's about the cross. And Jesus said, my God, why have you forsaken me? So you can't tell you can't give the gospel without talking about evil. But I said, let me try a secular one for you. Let me try a secular good that God can allow. I said, what if freedom, what if free will is a great gift that God gives, that many of us love free will more than we hate our pain? We love our free will more than we hate our pain. And he said, this atheist said, really? Do you think so? And I said, well, let's put it to the test. And I did not know where this was going. We were in a large home where about 50 people had gathered, and most of them were skeptics. They were mostly all scientists. I went to a scientific lab. Most of them were scientists. And I said, how many of you in this room? He said, well, let's ask them. And I said, yeah, let's do it. I said, how many of you would not, in exchange for giving up you could give up your pain and suffering, but you'd never be free again. God can't make you both. God cannot make you free and not causing wars and crime and other things in the universe. And I said, how many of you in this room? There were PhDs in this room. They were master students. They were scientists. And I said, most of them were unbelievers. And I said, how many of you you'll give up your freedom right now and get rid of your pain? Out of 52 people in that room, 1.5 people raised their hand. I say 1.5 because one of the guys that I had met had a PhD in physics, and he was putting his hand up and down, up. He couldn't decide, up and down, up and down. So I playfully said, that's a half. And he started laughing. And one other guy raised his hand. By the way, the up and down guy was not a Christian. And so out of the other 49 people, of the other 50 people in that room, 50 and a half to be exact, nobody wanted to trade. Nobody would trade their freedom for their suffering. They wanted their freedom and their suffering rather than no suffering and no freedom. That was amazing to me. And so I don't think the problem of suffering, it doesn't prove there's no God. Because Christians, look at the book of Job, look at David's suffering, look at Abraham's suffering, look at Jesus' suffering, look at Paul's suffering. John the Baptist was beheaded. Many of the early Christians were killed, Christians in general. There's a lot of suffering. Anyway, so suffering is something that both sides have to answer. I don't think it says anything against the resurrection.
Interesting one, isn't it? And we're at that stage in our culture at the moment where people are fighting against COVID restraint and they want their freedom back.
That's a good point, Kevin.
Okay, thank you for that. Bob Ratcliffe, you've got a question. You've had your hand up patiently for ages. Thank you.
Unmute. Fortunately, it was electronic, so I didn't have to put the effort in. Gary, I have a specific question from John chapter 20, which I read about some time ago, but I've not heard much on this. And it concerns when Peter reached the tomb, verse 5, he bent over and looked in at the strips of linen lying there, but did not go in. Then Simon Peter, who was behind him, arrived and went into the tomb. He saw the strips of linen lying there, as well as the burial cloth that had been round Jesus' head. The cloth was folded up by itself, separate from the linen. Finally, the other disciple had reached the tomb first, also went in. He saw and believed. Now, I read a number of years ago in a book that was written in the 1840s, that what this passage is really showing is that the grave clothes weren't discarded, but that they were complete together, more like a cocoon. And that's what convinced these disciples to believe. But I don't really have this explained or have this said much in Christian circles. Have you a view on that?
Yes. Very common view, that cocoon view. Let me explain the view first. The cocoon view is that the grave clothes that encased Jesus' body, he was gone, so the grave clothes collapsed, but they were all there together in one place, as if he had left the clothes and left the tomb without taking off the clothes. He just presumably went through them and presumably went through the rock. And so the graves are there, like the idea of the cocoon is sort of like the butterfly coming out of the cocoon, but leaving most of the cocoon intact. So we see these cocoons on trees and bushes, but the butterfly is gone. The reason you don't hear too much of that today is that Greek scholars do not think the Greek really argues like that. And what they say is the Greek can mean it that way. That could be true. The cocoon view could be true, but the Greek does not require that. And then it just could be that Jesus' clothes were all there neatly and he was gone. And someone could say, well, then how does that convince anybody that he was risen? Well, for that exact reason. Let's just say, for the sake of the argument, that Jesus took, and I'm not saying this at all, you can't tell this from the Greek, but let's say Jesus himself folded the clothes up like you make your bed in the morning and laid the folded clothes neatly on the rock. They would still be convinced, because the grave clothes are there, but the body's gone, and this tomb had been shut up. The tomb started out closed, and it was still closed when they came in. So you'd still get a resurrection. I'm just questioning that the cocoon story may not be exactly right, but the story that the grave clothes were still there, that's the main issue. They were still there, presumably neatly in one way or the other, cocoon or folded up. But they were all there, and he was nowhere to be found inside the tomb.
Good. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much indeed. Now, anybody else? Oh, we've got Joe Ogborn. Joe, would you like to ask your question? John, can you unmute him? Joe, hiya.
Yeah, hiya. Just a very simple question, really. I think most people, including myself, live lives where we don't study this all the time. So if you had to summarize your argument for the resurrection and what, if anything, we should go home and think about, if you want to put a stone in our shoes, what is the stone that you want to put there?
Okay, I'm missing the last few words.
What is the stone? You mentioned wanting to put, when you do lectures, about putting a stone in people's shoes so that it kind of sticks with you. I'm just trying to ask, what things, what facts do we want, should we think about on the back of this lecture?
Well, if I understand your question, what I just would have outlined in that lecture were the six minimal facts. And I'll tell you real quickly, those are the Jesus' death by crucifixion. The earliest disciples believed they saw the risen Jesus. They had real experiences. Third is the one I took a lot of time with, that was proclaimed very, very early. Fourth, their lives were absolutely transformed by the resurrection. And then two skeptics, James and Paul, became believers but they abandoned their unbelief and became believers when they believed that they had met the risen Jesus. So those are the six. By the way, on my website, GaryHabermas.com, you can find those six facts listed all over the place. Most of my lectures on the resurrection, I do those facts for anybody who wants to get them. Also, my YouTube channel, if you just go to YouTube and look up my name, there's many, I have about 100 lectures there, little short ones, and you can find those facts. But real quickly, that the crucifixion, the disciples' real experiences, the early proclamation right away of eyewitness proclamation right away, their transformed lives, and Paul and James, two unbelievers who come to Christ the same way because they thought they saw Jesus. Now, so back to your question, what am I trying to leave with these people? What are the stones that I'm trying to put in their shoes? I try to leave with them the facts, the good evidence that lead up to it, what the resurrection would do for a worldview even today. Paul says, for example, of 1 Thessalonians, he says, we grieve, but not as those without hope. I've already given you two cases of important deaths in my life. Kevin gave you one of an important death in his life. And Paul says, yeah, we're going to grieve when somebody dies, but not without hope. And there's a world of difference between grieving with hope, I will see him again, I will see her again, and grieving without hope, I will never see her or him again. So I lay the case out, and the stone I want to put in their shoe is, because of all these things, you have a decision to make whether to walk away and say it's rubbish, or you want to walk away and say, I want to know this man named Jesus. It's that ongoing question mark is the stone that I'm putting in their shoe for them to think about.
Okay. Thank you for that, Gary. Any more? Oh, Chris Shora. Chris.
Hi, Gary. This is more of a philosophical question, really, I think, than one based on evidence. But it does relate to your answer to one of Kevin's questions about the loss of your wife.
Yes.
And the need, understandable need, for restoration of that relationship in an afterlife. But in the UK particularly, relationships are really breaking down now or are very shallow. There's many, many reasons for this. We could go into it, but people are less keen on maintaining relationships and seeing them in an afterlife. So occasionally when I share with people about resurrection and afterlife, people come back and say, well, I don't really want to live forever. You know, I think living forever would be so tedious. It would be something that the last thing I would desire. And I wondered if you'd ever come across that sort of response when you talk about resurrection and afterlife, and if so, do you have an answer to it?
Yeah, you know what? That's a very, very perceptive response, because that same thing's happening in our country with broken relationships. And the person, now I would give several responses. I would say you might say you don't have responses, you don't have relationships like that, but I'll bet you you do. I'll bet you have closer relationships than you think you have, would be one thing I would say. But here's a better response. What if I said to that person, well, do you care about yourself? Do you want to live forever? And over the years, I have studied with or met some of the foremost atheists in the world. I studied under a person who was voted as the most influential psychotherapist in the world, PhD in clinical psychology. And this person scoffed at the afterlife, said over and over, no, I don't want there to be an afterlife. And yet I was listening to one of their lectures, and right in the middle of it, they said, of course I would like to live forever. Who wouldn't? I would absolutely want to live forever. But of course, there's no such thing as an afterlife. And then I've been told, don't quote me on this, but I've been told that Bart Ehrman said in a recent book of his, The New Testament Skeptic Here, Bart, forgive me if I'm misquoting you. Somebody told me, they sent me a quotation. They said that he said the same thing. He said, of course I would like to live forever, but I don't believe in an afterlife. Okay, another reason I would give is if you don't have a relationship with somebody you want to be with, do you want to be with yourself? I mean, would you like to be with yourself forever? Do you want good experiences to go on forever? And if the person says, no, not that either, then I might say, wow, can I hold your hand while we go to the emergency room to make sure you're not into suicide or some kind of, you know, Paul makes the comment, no man has ever hated his own life. We all have self-serving interests. And so I think if it wasn't for a loved one, I would go after their own existence. And I would also make that earlier point that I think they probably have better relationship with people than they think they have. I would use both of those, but I'd say, don't you want to live forever? Aren't you interested in that?
Okay. Thank you very much. Thank you, Chris. And I think, unless there's any other last questions, this is probably our cue. Oh, David Palmer. David, let's give you a go. You need to unmute.
Thanks. Yeah, hi. I wanted to hear your views on whether discussing the historical evidence for the resurrection, where does that come into preaching Christ crucified? How do these, where does it come to into our evangelism? So I guess it's a question of apologetics and straight sharing the gospel.
Let me see if I'm getting your question. Where does the resurrection come in when it comes to sharing the gospel?
Where does discussing the historical evidence, like right. kind of on a intellectual level, come into preaching Christ crucified?
Great. Yeah, good question. You know, I told you folks about my wife who passed away, the mother of my four children. I'm remarried. I could tell you about my current wife. I could tell you about my mother. I'm not sure how universalist is, but I can talk to a lot of people in my life, and those three women, my father, there's four. There's a lot of people who don't care two hoots about whether there's evidence or not. They just want to hear what it is and make a decision on whether this sounds like something I should get into, you know? Okay. So I want the person who, when you're presenting the gospel, I want the person, the Christian, to be versatile. So if the person is I don't need evidence, these people who I'm telling you, they don't need evidence in my life, my father and the three women, they would all say, when the speaker would come to church every year and he would give scientific evidence for intelligent design, or when somebody would come and give a lecture on archaeology, they would say, I'm always happy to hear that, but I don't need it. And that's what these folks will always say. I'm happy to hear it, but I don't need it. For the person who's happy to hear it, but they don't need it, I would just go for the existential push of all the religions. This is a little bit evidence, but if Christianity is easily the best evidence of all the religions. I could go into this question and do it for a PhD course easily, evidence for the Christianity as a whole. But if it's the path, if you're looking for a religious path, it's the evidential one. Oh, you don't need evidence? Well, let's present it as the most existentially fulfilling answer. And by that, I would mean it presents a path to eternal life. It gives you, let's look at it in threes. It makes sense of past history. It makes sense of present existence. Christianity gives you a path to live in the presence. You could say, well, so does atheism. But atheism can't guarantee oughts. It can't guarantee objective ethics, but Christianity can. So it gives you a way to live right now, political and ethical views, and it gives you a way to live in the future, because the atheist has nothing to say about that. But the Christian says that you can live forever with your loved ones, or Chris's question, with loved ones or with yourself. Christianity gives an existential answer that unifies past, present, and future. And I would say, I would use, for those who don't need evidences, I would say Christianity is the best unifying answer to all of our experience, including taking us into eternity. So I would, but if that person asks an evidential question along the way, I would be more than glad to talk about evidence at each one of those points.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Gary. Okay. I don't think we have any more questions queuing up in the wings. So what I'm going to do is begin to wrap it up and just ask Gary, just as a last point of emphasis for us to help prepare us all for Easter, to just ask you the question again, Gary, why does the resurrection change absolutely everything?
Yeah, that is the greatest question in the world, Kevin, because I think it does. Just in the testimony I gave, the resurrection answered my doubt. It gave me a lot more reason for living at present. And it gave me a hope for the future. When these two people died, up until that point, they were the most important people to me in my whole life. It unified everything together. So I think what the resurrection does, as I just explained a moment ago for David's question, it unifies the past with the present. And most importantly for most of us, especially the older we get, it takes us into the future where we can share with and live and have meaningful existence forever. You know, Kevin, I was thinking about your answer that you gave earlier about COVID and people. You know what? That was exactly the same kind of question, because people are saying, no, don't go out of your house because you could get sick out there. And they'll say, I'll take my chances. I've got to get out of my house. So not only did they say freedom instead of suffering, but they chose freedom in the face of suffering, i.e. catching COVID. So there's an example of that gift that God gives us. So I would still return to this. Christianity makes the most sense of the past, our freedom in the present, our relationships in the present, our absolute ethics in the present, our reason to live, and most of all, for those of us who've lost loved ones, a path to being unified with somebody in the future. To me, I can't think of a better belief system than one that ties everything together and gives me the most meaning in every single phase of life.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, thank you, Gary. This has been, for me, pure joy all the way through. So thank you very much indeed. And I hope for those of you who've taken the trouble to be with us this evening, if you're Christians tonight, that you'll find something here that you can take away to give a bit of extra impetus to your outreach this Easter and to make Easter for you a more meaningful celebration. And if you're not a believer, if you're not a Christian tonight, hopefully that Gary has put one of those pebbles in your shoe and given you something to think seriously about over this important season.